For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, a couple of your favorite Cro-Magnons, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle, and we're joined by Scott Cirk because we are discussing, are we in a post-Christian world? And quite frankly, we need help.
We sure, as usual.
one of the subjects, we were talking just a little bit off the air before we started, and it comes down to the discussion is today will be based on, are we living or looking at a world of 1984, or are we looking at a brave new world? And are either of those acceptable, or should we be scared?
That honestly sounds dark. I mean,
foreboding.
To start off with that as the dilemma. You know, I think we got to first talk. You know, are we really living in a dystopian world? I mean, this new post-Christian world that we're talking about.
Are we post-Christian? There's my question.
Well, we had talked a little bit about it and in a previous show, and I think we kind of when you look at it from the standpoint of the practices of the people, which is what we talked about, you have fewer and fewer people practicing Christianity. You have fewer and fewer people that, and then the bigger thing is the cultural influence of Christianity. To what extent is our culture formed and created, and our habits and practices as a people, are those informed by a Christian ethos? And that one, I think there was a little, we had a good discussion because it was a little bit more of a mixed bag. You know, on the one hand, I think when you look at things that are going on, they've got their roots in a Christian morality, but they've gone to a certain extent beyond Christianity in almost a bad way. So you've got a world that wants to be more Christian than us Christians. Oh, the church is not able anymore, according to the world, to fulfill what it means to be truly Christian, and so therefore the world has to take that. You know, you see that in things like the move for equity, correct? So the Christian church is not capable of understanding what it is to truly create a just society. Justice is no longer within the purview of the church. We outside the church know better what justice is than the Christians do and than what the church does. This is what the world says. And so you live in a world where things like justice, where things like courage, all the virtues are understood to be things that the rest of the world understands better than the church. Now, that's not to say that these weren't originally Christian virtues. All these Christian virtues have now been taken and turned on their head, and now they're being used to a certain extent against the church. And so that's kind of, that to me feels like the contours of this post-Christian world that we're living in.
Are you saying that the world is moving to Christianity without Christ? They don't want the figure of Christ, but they want the values of Christianity.
No, actually, what I'm saying is they've transformed the values of Christianity into almost a political weapon, a politicized weapon to be able to use for their own purposes and their own power. I think, you know, when Alistair MacIntyre, I know we promised a long time ago, Tim, we weren't going to name drop. We weren't going to name drop philosophers.
I like the name drop, though. It's been 4 years.
but the central chapter of Alistair MacIntyre's After Virtue. And I think when you're talking about a post-Christian world, I think that's a great place to start to understand what people are talking about post-Christianity, because he writes a book about how we've moved into post-modernity. And the modern movement was still very much a Christian movement. When you're looking at Descartes, when you're looking at Kant, when you're looking at Locke, you're looking at Christians. These are Christian thinkers. We not always agree with them, but they're still Christian thinkers. But now that we've moved beyond them, we've moved into a post-Christian world. But the central chapter of his book was, what do we do now? Where do we go now? And he said the dilemma for this sort of postmodern world that we live in is going back to Aristotle, going back to an understanding of the world according to Aristotle. And the way we understand Aristotle now is very much filtered through the lens of St. Thomas Aquinas. So going back to a Thomistic, Aristotelian understanding of things, or Nietzsche. That is our dilemma. Is it Nietzsche or is it Aristotle? And the reason he says that is because for Nietzsche, everything is really about the use of power. Truth itself is difficult to find. It's hard to find what truth is. So all that we're left with is this large power game of who is going to be able to wield the most power. And so I think in this Nietzschean world that we've got, what used to be Christian virtues are being wielded as tools of power, tools of manipulation, tools to be able to put my agenda and my purposes and things ahead of yours. And so I think that's kind of, that's the post-Christian world we live in as far as the way I see it.
Well, we should probably spend just a quick second here before we get too far down the road and just talk and welcome Scott Cirque. Welcome. So if you heard this other voice, Mark was off to the races, buddy. We're eager to talk about this, but we have a great friend of the show in the Catholic Cave once again, Scott Cirque. And he's here because you're a faithful, practicing Catholic. You are very active in, I'll just call it, the sphere of law as an attorney and as a judge. So, but you're also very, very well read on these different issues, so these cultural issues. I know you and I, outside of the cave, when we're in our one, are always sharing different books that we're reading and things like that, and have we both share a passion, as does Mark with and Kent, around some of the big names like Peter Kraft and things like that. So there's another name drop. He's a great right. Catholic author. Yep. So I'm going to what I might say around this question of dystopian, I'm going to probably. I'm not going to disagree. I'm going to see it as maybe kind of a where there's kind of an overlap, like two spheres where they're partially intersecting. There's some overlap. There's some differences, and I would say there's sort of a where there's sort of an emerging post-Christian culture while there still is a remnant of I would say the authentic faith here in the United States. Part of what I think is happening, you mentioned Nietzsche is maybe one of the culprits. McIntyre is a way to kind of offering us maybe a path forward. I'm going to say it is Nietzsche is one of the main influences. But I'm still going to go back. I also think the current setting is dominated by a kind of a Marxist understanding of things, of oppressors and the oppressed. That is all, and this is going to sound like an odd couple, and this is where Carl Truman, who we've interviewed here on the show before, I think he puts his finger on something. There's also a kind of odd couple with Marx and Freud, as he's kind of put his finger on it, and then this as you mentioned, this will to power of Nietzsche though has also been and that the transvaluation of ethics is also incorporated with Michel Foucault. And the reason why Foucault, because Michel Foucault, who you can YouTube, you can see is relatively recent French philosopher, he's a big troublemaker in my mind. And he introduces this notion of deconstruction, where everything is basically, he identifies, especially language, is basically infused with power structures. These power structures are illegitimate and used as forms of oppression. And then the by oppressors, either explicitly or implicitly, this is where you begin. So from this flows things like unconscious bias, microaggressions, all these kinds of things flow out of, I think, what Foucault had sort of proposed.
Right. And most importantly is the whole idea of these things being systemic. So this idea that biases and power and those things are exercised through institutions and not necessarily through individuals. I think that's probably one of Foucault's bigger sort of contributions to this whole sphere. Is it's the whole system that creates these types of things.
This use of language is interesting to me because in the transgender, as far as we had a conference for judges, and they said we had a woman who spoke on transgender, and she said, refer to transgenders not as he or she, but as they or them or him, the plural instead of the singular. And I think, again, that just doesn't make sense. People are not plural. And I think the point of my response to her talk was that we should just treat everyone with kindness and courtesy, but to create or change or modify the language is a it just doesn't make sense. And that's somewhere where we're going in this world that you said of this dominated by Marx and Freud and the French philosopher.
Yeah, Foucault. Yeah. Joseph Pieper, I think it's pronounced. He's a great Catholic philosopher of the 20th century. His book that's really helpful is Abuse of Language, Abuse of Power. And one example, and so this is where I think it give one of the things I think as we're talking about this, we put our finger that he puts his finger on, although I don't think he uses this specific example, but he does talk about the I'll call it like a weaponization of language. One area that I think we're all very familiar with is in pro-life ministry, and how pro-abortion advocates use euphemisms in order to shape shape and move the conversation in their direction. And so language does, because, I mean, just go back to the word choice. Like, who could be against choice? You know, the people are just pro-choice. Why are you anti-choice? Well, I'm not anti-choice. I think people should make choices. In fact, I'm a big proponent. People should make good choices. Aren't you? Yes. But so this framing of this grabbing language and then freighting, then transvaluing them into a new meanings with to serve nefarious purposes is a real challenge for us.
On that theme, Black Lives Matter. Some people have said they're the same philosophy of Black Panthers. They've just had a better marketing plan, and I think there's some of that that's going on with the. The use of choice as opposed to the reality of that you're destroying a human life. So I think that's something we need to be aware of in some way.
Yeah, there's a lot of examples when it comes to things that are just out there in the culture. So when I try to think about bringing it back to, well, speaking of bringing it back, we'll have to bring it back after this break. Let's talk about what are some of the features. Mark kind of got us there. And you're moving in that direction too, Scott. Let's talk about what are some of the features of our current setting so that we can determine, have we really moved into a post-Christian culture or not? So with that.
And we'll be back to talk about just that here on The Catholic Cave. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Alexa, what's the weather forecast for today?
Alexa, what time is the Colts game today?
Alexa, remind me to pick up the dry cleaning tomorrow.
Has Alexa become a part of your daily routine? Then make sure that routine includes Alexa. Play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Quick, easy access to Catholic programming 24/7. Just say, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. In the Catholic Cave, of course, I'm speaking, so I'm here. And then Tim O'Donnell.
You only think.
Right. That almost was like a Descartes moment. You know, I think, therefore I am. I speak, therefore I must be here. So, and also that was Mark. And then Kent Blanford's here. And our special guest, welcome back, Scott Cirque. And we're trying to get at this notion. It's kind of like a part two, the show of post-Christian culture and the setting that we're in. And one of the areas, because we started to talk about it, I think in an ancillary fashion, hinting at it, it feels like today. So I'm going to throw a question out. It feels like today, everything has become political. Like everything is in the political sphere. And like there's nothing, like the political sphere has really engulfed everything. Do you think that's true? And if it's true, what might be causing that? And then what might be some of the implications of that?
I definitely think it is true. We're more focused on politics and less focused on faith, just in general, and knowledge and that type of thing. And it tends to overcome all issues. And we've even gotten to where our politics has gotten divided based on faith, which is probably an unfortunate thing. One party is went extreme pro, for example, on the abortion issue, extreme pro-choice. Well, the other party is fighting for life. So there is that problem. And just taking President Biden and his career, he was much more of a Catholic yet Democrat until certainly when he joined the Obama ticket. He then went to where he's now pro, just our prior most pro-abortion president, as well as totally in the transgender and those issues. So that's unfortunate, and that's again where politics seems to override a person's faith.
Where do you feel any political pressure in your role as a judge or in the judicial system? Do you feel that, or how do you guard against that? Because obviously you want to be impartial, right? And Lady Justice is blind,
yeah,
right. What's the setting like now?
Well, we truly have to be, as that's truly how the judges should be. So, and when I was saying that criticism of President Biden, I was trying to do as gently or as fairly as I can. But yeah, I think that's very much there. Like I said earlier about the transgender role, we're definitely hearing from the State Supreme Court and others when we have conferences and things like that, that transgender is kind of the way of the future, or we need to treat it in this way. And I'm not sure, it causes me some concerns, honestly. And I think we're more focused on that than we are what's really the cause of a lot of the problems in society, which is the breakdown of the family. I think the breakdown of the family is probably a greater cause of the difficulties and challenges that we're having in the family, that you're not having, fathers aren't as respected as they were, and there's less commitment to family above all of the things. And then that, so we have that concern. So I think we need to focus on that. But that gets in the whole area of sexual freedom, and that's the one thing that I think the left will not tolerate. If we try to restrain sexual freedom, that's something that will not be tolerated.
Yeah, I think that breakdown of family and breakdown of community gets back to your question of why have we become so hyper-politicized? Because I think when you have a society that's based around intact families, and then those families go and create a healthy community that's based around family life to a good extent, your life is not consumed with I think trying to use politics to get what you want. You've got a life that revolves around family, job, community, these types of things, rather than trying to use the system to get and have whatever I want. And I think as family life has decreased, politics in a lot of ways has moved in to fill that void. I mean, we all live within now political tribes to a certain extent. And in a lot of ways, our identity. I mean, if you're not identifying yourself according to gender, etc., you're identifying yourself according to politics. So the next layer isn't so much, of me being identified based upon my preferences, but me being identified based upon whom I vote for and what I believe in and where I stand. And I think so as we've been identifying people less and less by our surnames, we begin to identify ourselves much more by politics and where we stand on various issues.
Yeah.
I think you're onto something there. One of the features is let's stipulate for a minute, and we can, it's debatable, you know, the role of faith in public life. If it is in fact receding here in the U.S., other parts of the West, if it is in fact receding, I think there's evidence that it is. It's not, there isn't a void that it's as faith recedes. It's maybe being displaced even by a different kind of set of understandings. Sometimes it's referred to as secular humanism. It can also be called a kind of irreligion. Ross Douthat, who we've talked about before, you know, kind of puts his finger on this decadent society.
Yeah, and nation of heretics.
Nation of heretics.
Right.
And I think Joshua Mitchell, who we've had on the program before, his book also, I think, talks about kind of like there's this great awakening. It's a spiritual awakening, but not as a traditional Christian sense. But there are terms, for example, that are being. And you were mentioning this in the first segment, I think, Mark. There are terms that have really been part of the lexicon of the Judeo-Christian tradition that are now being applied in new ways that we might identify as either heretical, to use theological terms, or given entirely new sets of meanings, one of which is this, the original sin. So I've heard it in different articles, different lectures and stuff. So the founding, so as it pertains to the founding of America, because with, you know, when America was founded and, you know, for the first 100 years of our nation's history, there was slavery in the southern states. And so slavery is termed as America's original sin. And so notice, and then therefore, the argument goes, this original sin, that means it's applied in a kind of theological sense, in that there's, because of that founding, with slavery as a part of the founding of the country, that there's it taints everything. Just so the Christian understanding of original sin is that we're all born with original sin that's inherited from our original parents, Adam and Eve, and it's baptism then that saves us from original sin and grafts us into the body of Christ. This original sin of the founding of America, it stated, there's no getting out of it. That's why it's systemic. It sort of pollutes, it's contaminated our lives, our institutions, and there really is no, I think Joshua Mitchell points this out, there really is no redemption from it. There isn't a forgiving, salvific, redemptive mechanism by which one can extricate oneself. So it all has to be torn down.
Yeah. I think that's very on point as to how they view it. I would say, you know, slavery was a whore. There's no excuse for it. How, particularly the type that came into the West, had a racial component to it. However, through blood, through over 600,000 deaths in the Civil War, and then Lincoln's great second inaugural, I would say we should go that we paid the cost of that sin. And where he said there's no more fault to the North or the South, we're all responsible. But there's a political element there that does not accept that, going back to the 1619 as the founding of America as opposed to 1776. So I think you make an excellent point there.
Yeah, that's a whole nother show, the 1619 Project.
Right.
I think that was launched by New York Times, New York Magazine.
Yeah, it was a New York Times. It was a New York Times project to try to go back and sort of trace the lineage of the United States back to the beginning of slavery, right. And that
a lot of that I think got bunked from what I read.
I mean, history. The philosophy of history. You're exactly right, Tim. We could do an entire show on sort of the philosophy of history and what makes good history, what makes bad history. That would be a good show topic.
Here's why I think things might be, and it will come up on a break here in a couple of minutes. So I'll try to make this short. I think one of the reasons that things may have evolved into being everything sort of being engulfed by the political sphere. And that goes back to Lord Acton. And Lord Acton made the point that, who's a great Catholic intellectual, made the point that it was really religion that was sort of the other sphere of our lives that really put limits on the political sphere. And so if you think of these two, think of like two billiard balls. They're sort of the same size coming into contact with one another. Well, if one billiard ball, though, starts to shrink, namely the religious sphere shrinks, the other one is much more like when it pushes up against it, it's not meeting sort of I don't want to get Manichaean and say they're equal and opposite forces.
Right.
But just analogy, the political sphere begins to get larger and larger and larger. So threats against or losses to things like religious freedom, religious liberty, the loss of faith in the public square, again, isn't creating a vacuum or a void where nothing is there any longer. No, it's the political sphere is engulfing it. Part of why that's happening, too, is if God sort of becomes an unnecessary proposition in one's life, then one is going to look to other principles of ways to organize one's life, what ways to organize one's society. Therefore, the political political means, political activity is what people would find recourse to.
Right. And I also think that dovetails with what we were talking about before, that you also have an agenda setting going on. So when religion recedes, the agenda that's being set is no longer being set by religious ideals. Now the agenda is being set by political ideals, and that shades even religion itself. So we're kind of coming up on another break, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about this sort of difference in the agendas of the political versus the religious.
And that'll be coming up right after this break. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Boy, it sure is dark in here. I guess that's why they call it The Catholic Cave. Each Saturday at 9 and Sunday at 11 a.m., The Catholic Cavemen, Timothy O'Donnell, Mark Tuttle, and Kemp Blanford, as well as lots of interesting guests, shine a Catholic light on just about everything, from ancient Greek philosophers to doctors of the church to today's movies and TV. Nothing escapes their ever-inquisitive eyes. It's a fun, informative program. If you own or manage a business, you can help keep programming like The Catholic Cave on the air by becoming an underwriter. It's not costly, and you'll be helping to keep quality Catholic programming on the air. To find out more, call Val at 317-870-8400. 317-870-8400. She can tell you all about it. Or email valerie@catholicradioindy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. Tim O'Donnell still here. That's me. Mark Tuttle. Scott Cirque. Welcome, Scott. So glad you're here with us. Kemp Blanford. Okay, so before the break, Mark, I think where you were leading it, or where I'd like us to go, picking up on where you left off, let's talk about the common good.
Right, because I do think that sort of is, when I was talking about the agenda, you know, the agenda is being set by politics rather than religion. It is that notion of the common good, right? We all, I mean, going back to Aristotle, we've got Aristotle or Nietzsche, and we're kind of talking about the intersection of both here. You know, we all desire some notion of happiness, and then that gets magnified into the political, that we all want to live in a quote-unquote happy society. But when you have less and less of a religious understanding of what makes a happy society, it's not like you have a void. I mean, something's going to fill that void, and then that becomes various competing political understandings of what the common good is.
I think one of the ways in which that manifests itself is, I think, the eschaton. And the reason why I say the eschaton, so the sort of the four last things, I would say, you know, the Christian understanding, the Catholic understanding is we have, you know, we have death, judgment, heaven, and hell. So there's something more. There's something more. The purpose of life, of this life, is to know God, love God, serve him in this life so we can be with him and happy forever in heaven. Well, if that's the, that's a, you know, a pretty standard Baltimore Catechism view of the purpose of my life and the purpose of your life. We share that common purpose. Now, if you move into a political sphere where there's a, call it an atheism or a kind of a practical atheism at least, then there seems to be what's vanished is this understanding of anything that comes after this life. So if there isn't, if I'm not concerned with what comes after death, if I'm not concerned about a judgment of how I've lived my life, and then a heaven or hell as a sort of eternal reward or eternal punishment, then my priorities change to this life only. And when I've eclipsed eternal life in favor, by favoring what's going on in the here and now and what's going on in my life now, then my projects, my priorities, my philosophy are all going to shift in that direction, or not just shift, but even be formed in that direction. I'm no longer aligning myself, discerning the life that God has in store for me, but rather I become the builder of my own destiny. And that's why I need political power, because I need political power because I need to maximize my own autonomy, my own decision-making, and access to resources in order for me to carry out my own set of desires. And I think this is where Charles Taylor goes with his understanding.
Well, I was going to, in a book that I recently read, Things Worth Dying For by Archbishop Chaput, he has a great point on page 26 of that book. The idea that we own our own bodies and selves and command the course of our lives is, as the devil Screwtape would say, equally funny in heaven and in hell.
And I thought that's a great quote, and
I think that sums up what you're saying there, Tim, mm-hmm. in that we have a whole movement that believes we control our lives and we're ignoring our Lord.
Yeah, but I do think, Tim, when the shift focuses to the here and now, it doesn't jettison this idea of the eschaton. And I think a lot of what we see within sort of modern society is this attempt to build a paradise here on earth. So I think, you know, we're, in some ways we're back to the biblical, you know, Tower of Babel of trying to create a way here on earth that we can reach a perfect society. So I think there is a lot of, it's not just looking at the here and now, it's looking at the future, but it's looking at the future as I've conceived it. And so there's even more urgency then to become political about it, because it's not just about me, but it's about the future. It's about future generations, and it's about creating a world that's in my image down the road. And so I think that even puts more urgency on politicizing things and utilizing the power that I have to magnify my own, you know, my own vision. But once again, it's a vision that's not created through a religious understanding, but through a political understanding of what a paradise would look like.
Well, I would generally agree, but I think one of the, it depends when you say future, like how far down the road. I find the drop in birth rates alarming, and I think that's a very strong piece of evidence that says the future doesn't go much beyond my own life, because I'm not really building a future through propagating the species. I'm not having children. We're not having children to hand on whatever we're building. So I think it's much more about building a life that suits me and not so much about what goes on with the next generation.
Yeah, I don't know. I recognize what you're saying about the drop of birth rates, but I don't think it's quite as conscious as that. And I don't think it's necessarily a I'm giving up on the idea that there's going to be a future, but I think it's that, yeah, the future is going to be filled with other people other than me. And, you know, I need to pass along my ideas and my understanding, and not just mine, but I've obviously got a whole group of people that you know, think similar to me. We have to make sure that our viewpoint is going to prevail. So, you know, I don't know that they have quite given up on the idea that there's going to be a future.
Well, I think that the future is bleak. I think it's a kind of hopelessness. I think maybe even Pope Benedict talked about that a little bit. But here, let me give you an example where I think it maybe is pretty prevalent. If one adopts the notion, if you become convinced that you can become convinced, and I think a lot of people are, that human beings are really a problem for the Earth. I think that's not everyone, but there's a significant number of people who think human beings are a real problem for the Earth because pollution and by our very existence. So we need to. There's active, powerful institutions and people behind institutions that are promoting abortion, contraception, small families. Driving down birth rates on purpose to reduce humanity's footprint.
Right, to reduce humanity's footprint, not to bring about the extinction of humanity. Now, there are a few people, which is they're strange people to talk to. There are a few people out there that would advocate for the extinction of the human race. But I think the more prevalent view is, no, for the good of the human race, we need to have lower populations and smaller. And once again, you know, this is a politically induced vision of
right. What
would be best for humanity long down the road. You know, so it isn't a short-sighted view. This is a far-sighted view of what is going to make a paradise and how we can bring it about through political means. And so that seems to be to me more the driving force than, well, Tim, you do you and me do me. You know, the two kind of tend to coexist, but I definitely think there's a motivation that goes well beyond just what's good for me in the here and now behind a lot of what we're seeing.
I think that's one of the paradoxes, and I'm not sure I've got it all worked out, but there is this notion of this very strong notion in the current setting of I need to maximize my autonomy. I need to be free to pursue my own goals and aspirations that I've set for myself. Again, this is sort of an eclipse of God and God's providential plan for my life. Human beings are social, so there's also this political component that I also need to be affirmed in whatever I'm choosing to do with myself. And so this is where you can kind of see often policies, force of law. Scott, you were talking about it earlier, why there's even and going back to like how Jordan Peterson kind of got launched into the public square is this notion of enforcing kind of pronoun changes. And so why would you use policies that would threaten one, say, employment or laws that rise to the level of hate crime? Why is it that language is now seen as violence? We used to understand violence as really physical harm.
Right. I think we all grew up on the playground with, you know, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. You know, now that's almost been turned around of, physical violence isn't going to hurt you, but the words that are said, that's what's going to do damage.
Well, it's an inversion, right? It's an inversion. And to be sure, psychological trauma is very real and can be very damaging and last a lifetime and create a lifetime of woundedness. But at the same time, though, it is a kind of transvaluation where psychological damage, psychological harm is really seen on a higher plane morally as a bigger moral problem than physical. So when you say something, if you make a statement that could someone disagrees with, somehow harms their psychological well-being, that creates a firestorm of retribution. And that, I think, gives rise a little bit to something probably going to spend a whole nother show on, which is kind of cancel culture, right? Cancel culture is that sort of Rene Girardian scapegoat mechanism that has to remove one from society completely for a transgression. And the transgression isn't because of physical violence. It's psychological violence that's occurred.
Yeah, I think Mark's point was very good. We used to say, I may disagree with what you're saying, but I defend with my life your right to say it. And now we've went the exact opposite. We're so sensitive, we don't want any other view out there except the one we agree with, and we're moving toward that type of society, which I think is a detriment to us.
And we need to take a break. We'll be back with more on the topic of, are we living in a post-Christian world? Here on the Catholic Cave, you're listening to Catholic Radio Indy.
So, the scan button brought you here. Awesome. We like company. Get to know us. And if you have to leave, come back. You're always welcome. Catholic Radio Indy.
At Catholic Radio, we love to hear from you. Call us anytime. Just recently, we found this message on our voicemail.
I'm a non-Catholic that listens to your Catholic radio station, and I just wanted to thank you guys. I listen to Catholic Answers and Al Cresta sometimes, and I think her name's Teresa Tommy. I listen to her and another show or two. I appreciate it.
Call us at 317-870-8400 and let us know what you're thinking.
I just called to say, even though I'm not a Catholic, I listen to your station.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a website, CatholicRadioIndy.org, with access to great Catholic resources, including podcasts of all our local programming, podcasts that have been downloaded from all 50 states and over 40 countries on 6 continents. Yes, we are Catholic Radio Indy, but thanks to your support, we're taking the gospel of Christ to the ends of the earth. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. Tim O'Donnell, Mark Tuttle, Scott Cirque, Kent Blanford. Now, I've been name dropping all show. And the last name I dropped was the great Catholic philosopher Rene Girard.
Yes, you let the cat out of the bag, because quite honestly, we have been talking about Girard, and we've been talking about this post-Christian world in Girardian terms the whole show. So, this whole discussion has been pretty much Girard.
So unpack that a little bit for the audience. Right. What do you mean by that?
I know. You know, I mentioned Rene Girard. There's a there's a panel discussion on Girard in the media coming up. And I mentioned that to my wife. And she said, you know, you and Tim are probably the only people in the whole city of Indianapolis who really know who Rene Girard is. So who is this Rene Girard guy that you guys keep talking about? So Rene Girard was a French philosopher. He died probably about 5 years ago.
Five or ten.
Not long ago at all. And the basis of Girard's theory is that humanity is pretty much made up of this idea of a constantly changing identity of whom we wish to become. He's not unique in that. I mean, that's to a certain extent Aristotle, that's Plato. I mean, all of philosophy, I think, leads in that understanding of mankind, that we create ourselves to a good extent in the images that we see. But for Girard, those images were cast by others. And so we model ourselves after people that we want to become. Now, the problem that Girard sees is we might want to become these people, but other people want to become these people too. And that creates rivalries. So I may want to be the type of person that drives a Lamborghini, but there are other people in the world that want to become the type of person that drives a Lamborghini too. And they get in my way. And so this starts to begin to create conflict. And as conflict is created, it starts to mount. And it becomes a societal wide problem until suddenly there becomes a transformation and all of these rivalries and seeing other people as obstacles to getting what we want, we begin to have agreement on who's the real obstacle to getting what we want. And suddenly we may have multiple people that want to be the type of people that want to drive Lamborghinis, and there's only one person that's in the way, and that's usually the person that owns the Lamborghini. So then that person suddenly becomes, in Gerard's point of view, a scapegoat. They become somebody that all of society can blame their problems on. And the solution is to get rid of the scapegoat, to expel that scapegoat, get rid of them. And then for Gerard, this is the source of religion, the idea of an act of violence that gets rid of the scapegoat. And then that scapegoat, because by getting rid of them, this is a ritual now that's brought about peace. It's brought about tranquility within society. That becomes transformed into a religious ritual with this scapegoat now being transformed into a god. And, you know, Gerard later in life became Catholic because he saw that Christianity was sort of not only the opposite of this, but in some ways the original template of this. Yeah. That by modeling ourselves off of Christ and sacrificing ourselves and dying to ourselves and being the ones that can say, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do," we sort of dismantle this whole system. And the whole system of rivalry and all of that falls apart in the face of Christianity. And so, in a lot of ways, Gerard was the original philosopher of post-Christianity. You know, he saw that the Christian world had completely melted away the pagan world over time. And now what we were left with was a world that, as Christianity began to recede, now what was starting to rise in its place wasn't going back to paganism, but a weaponized version of Christianity. And that's kind of where we started our discussion, that now Christians are becoming, once again, kind of the scapegoats. The Christian worldview is the source of all of the world's problems. And what's being used against it are the very Christian notions, of loving, you know, loving your brother as yourself, justice, all of these things that, you know, the pagan world of justice and truth. You know, you go back to Pilate, when Pilate asked that question, you know, what is truth? You know, the pagan world really didn't care what was true. The pagan world really didn't care what was just. The pagan world just cared what was going to give Caesar power.
Right.
And so we've gone back to that, but now what's being used are these very Christian ideas of justice to once again sort of accumulate and project power.
Yeah.
It seems to me Gerard with having identified the scapegoating mechanism that had been present, had been present different cultures, different mythologies and various pagan religions is kind of reemerging, and that is in that cancel culture, where again, like you said, Mark, there's an identification of the other, the stranger, the minority, and then the society turns on them, and because it's repetitive, it becomes ritualized. But you have to drive out the scapegoat. You have a really good example of in Leviticus, where you see that's in Leviticus, you actually see the actual where we get the term scapegoat from, because they would transfer, the high priest would transfer the sins of the people with the laying on of hands onto the goat, and then the goat would be driven out, carrying the sins of the people out of the city, out of society, into the wilderness, unto death, off a cliff, and you can see that. But then people continue to sin, and that, like you mentioned, so Gerard talks about that mimicking others inevitably produces rivalries. The rivalries create a kind of violent tension that then becomes cathartic through this ritual. This, I think, one of his books called "Sacred and Violence." And so through that, then sort of peace emerges after you destroy the scapegoat. Peace emerges temporarily, but inevitably builds back up, and you have to repeat it over and over and over again. You see it done magnificently in Mel Gibson's movie Apocalypto, where in Apocalypto there's a depiction of I don't remember if it's the Aztecs or the Mayans, but you see that there's this pagan society, very powerful, and they are going through a drought, and the way that they're going to, they believe the drought is caused because the sun god is angry with them, and so that's withholding rain, and or the rain god is angry at them, some one of their part of their pantheon, and so the way to demands human sacrifice. So they send out these war parties to capture people that don't belong to their society, and then they execute them in public fashion until it starts to rain. And so this is, and then when it starts to rain, you know, harmony and peace are restored, you know, crops are able to grow, people aren't going to starve. But eventually, guess what happens? Well, another drought, you know, and so it all has to be repeated. It's all very ritualized and things like that. And I think there's an element of that in this. That's one of the features, I think, of this when we look at elements of a post-Christian culture.
Listening to you great philosophers, me just being a regular guy, I think of the ultimate scapegoat is Christ. And I think that's what you're saying. Christ is the ultimate scapegoat. And the other thing I got from that is we live much more in a Pilate world than a Caiaphas world, in that we are very much, in a sense, Pilate knew what were the right thing to do, but he wouldn't do it. He didn't have the courage to do it. He sacrificed Christ for the popularity.
And he was kind of warned by his wife, too.
And he was warned by his wife, whereas Caiaphas was very hard.
See, we should always, husbands should always listen to their wives.
It was very hard tyranny.
Did you get that, honey?
Very good point. It was very hard tyranny as opposed to the soft tyranny.
Right. You know, and I think it's Peter Kreft got to the sort of the same idea when he said, you know, identity is based around not who your friends are, but who your enemies are. You know, the more and more we identify with who we are against rather than who or what we're for. And we see that in politics. I think that's part of why everything has shifted to becoming political, is our identity is very much based on who it is we are seeing as the source and cause of evil within our world. You know, if you see the right types of people as the evil in the world, that binds you to other people, and you wind up with your political enemy based on who needs to be expelled. Who are these people we need to get rid of? That's really sort of what defines politics these days.
That's very well said.
Yeah, that and right. And I think that's what you're talking about, that what led Girard into the Catholic faith, is that he recognized, that was so distinctly different about Christianity, is that this scapegoating, this ritualistic violence, the scapegoating mechanism to appease the god or gods, Christianity was very different because God became one of us. He became the scapegoat himself and suffered the punishment, and therefore redeemed or saved us from our sins, one sacrifice for all.
Right. And he set a pattern for the rest of us to follow.
Right.
And it's a pattern of forgiveness. And I think when you're talking about this post-Christian world that we live within, Christianity is still very much relevant. You know, it's not like Christianity has gone away. It's not like hell has suddenly prevailed against the church. The church is still here, and we still have a mission. And, you know, as we continue as Christians, it becomes incumbent on us to see what's going on in the world, see these groups that are being formed to expel and to try to get rid of and try to cancel and try to shut down. And we have to kind of stand in the place of Christ to a certain extent and allow ourselves to, in some ways, become the sacrificial victim and at the same time say, I forgive them. Not let it continue, but use forgiveness to end the cycle.
Excellent point. And I guess it goes to the point we're all searching for a solution. The atheists, the world, everyone's searching for the solution. And the solution is Christ. And a lot of the great intellectuals like Girard, and then even more common intellectuals like Robert Bork and Mortimer Adler, at the end of their lives, they left atheism and became Catholics. And I think we're all searching for that, our atheist friends, our worldly friends, and the answer is Christ.
And with that wraps it up for this week. We've been discussing, are we living in a post-Christian world? Think about that this week while you're going about your daily lives, and we'll come up with an even more deep subject for next week. For Timothy O'Donnell, for Mark Tuttle, for Scott Cirque, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, thanks for listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. Be holy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.